What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. Got a great guest this week, actually this week and next, Joe Buck, who is the number one play-by-play guy for Fox. He has called numerous World Series, numerous Super Bowls, All-Star Games, golf tournaments. He is a seven-time Emmy winner. He was hired by Fox in 1994. He was only 25 years old at the time. He has a great book called Lucky Bastard, My Life, My Dad, and the Things I'm Not Allowed to Say on TV. Well, he'll be saying some of those things here on the podcast. Also, he is going to be a guest host on Jeopardy August 9th. Through the 13th. This is a two-parter. Part one, we talk a lot about Jeopardy, his dad, the great Jack Buck, and also baseball. That's part one with Joe Buck this week on Hollywood and Levine. I want to start out by talking about Jeopardy, because you are the guest host on August 9th through the 13th. How did that come about?
It was something that came up last year, right after Alex passed away. I met with their producer, Mike Richards, and I really haven't talked about this publicly, so this is a huge scoop for you with me with Jeopardy. And it was something they had interest in me. I had interest in getting on the list. And I met with Mike for a couple of hours. I would say it was probably the end of November, maybe early December. And we talked about, you know, how the show was likely to change going forward, and that they were putting this list together. And I said, I'd just like to be on the list. I'd like to see if it's something that I'm good at. I don't know. I think I check a lot of boxes for you, and that I can listen to somebody talking to me in my ear, and I can continue to talk and make sense out of my own mouth while I'm listening to somebody else and trying to process that information.
Which,
and,
by the way, is a very difficult skill.
It's weird. It's, you have two tracks going on, and when I've had people, as I digress, but I've had people from the music industry, the acting world, really even people that kind of get up and read a lot of teleprompter, sit in a broadcast booth with me when I'm doing TV and listen in the headset and listen to somebody counting me backward going to break, or as I'm trying to, you know, hit their marks, and they walk out of there like, how in the hell do you listen to somebody while you're talking? But so I said, you know, I don't know that people, even though I've done a bunch of World Series and Super Bowls, I don't know that people know all that I can do. So, you know, if you have interest in me, I have a lot of interest in just doing it for a week and seeing how it goes. And I've since obviously done it. You know, we're a couple of weeks away from it airing, and it went well. And they were really happy with it. The crew was all kind of talking to me off to the side, like, you know, this is like you've been doing this your whole life kind of stuff. So it felt comfortable. I enjoyed it. I'll see how it looks when it hits the air. I just can't have no point of reference to know if it went well or not. I think it did. And then we'll just see how it looks and sounds once August 9th rolls around. I'm as interested as theoretically anybody else is.
Now, were they talking in your ear during
the game?
A little bit. You know, because it's COVID and they were really strict at the time, the studio audience was made up of the contestants that were about to challenge the winner.
Right.
So there's a section of people way smarter than I am. And then there's a section of Mike Richards, a producer. The director was back in the booth, but a lot of the writers were out there. So I think if it were normal times, there would have been more talking in my ear, but it was to the point now, because the audience was cleared out for the most part, that if there was any question I had as to whether an answer was going to be accepted or not, I could look down into the front row and they're giving me thumbs up or thumbs down. And then the only talking that was in my ear was when we were about to take a break and go to a commercial and kind of, you know, after this response, go to break, or, you know, whatever it was, but it was minimal. And you know, if I was bogging down, Mike would say, speed it up. If I was going too fast, he'd say, slow it down. It was that kind of stuff, but nothing really intense with regard to them talking to me while I was doing it.
How'd you prepare for it?
Well, I read Alex's book, which he wrote, I guess, just prior to him passing away, because it really ends just about at the time that, you know, he covers everything that's in there that really was his life from beginning to end. I read that book. I watched a ton of Jeopardy, which I watched anyway. But when you, it's different to watch it when you're just a fan or you're sitting around and it's on, compared to when you know you're about to go host. So now you're looking for, okay, how do they get in from commercial break? How do they segment the show? What are the words that they use? And what words are kind of verboten from, you know, like, these are not answers, these are responses. These are not bets, these are wagers. It was kind of like doing the U.S. Open for the USGA. That's not a tee box, that's a teeing ground. That's not a driving range, it's a practice tee. It's not a sand trap, it's a bunker. It's not a pin, it's a flag stick. So you have to, you know, eliminate a lot of words that kind of come naturally, and just play by their rules and understand how these each block works. I felt really comfortable by the time I went in and rehearsed for a day and then did it for a full day, which was five shows worth.
And you would go in the morning, like at 6-7 o'clock, and see all of the clues. I guess they call them clues.
Correct. Well done, Ken. You pass.
And there have to be a lot of them that are tough to pronounce. You have to figure out or talk to somebody as to how to pronounce all of these things, because those are tough.
Even then, when you're under the gun, what you can go, okay, yeah, I'll just spell it out phonetically on what I have in front of me. But even, you know, then it gets in your head and you're trying to go fast and you have that little seed of doubt, and then you're tripped and you can't pick yourself back up. So what they have always done, and what Mike said, is if you screw up a clue, just get to the end of it and we'll pick it up at the end, which they did for 15 guest hosts and did for Alex. You know, if you make a mistake, you go back and pick it up. It's a taped show. But the cool part, or the interesting part to me, was he said that the contestants are not listening to you at all. When they call for a category and that comes up full screen on the board, they're just reading it off the board. You could go blah, 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 blah. And then they would ring in with the answer. So it was kind of like, just fumble your way all the way to the end of the sentence, and then we'll pick it up at the end. So by the time it hits the air, it's been, you know, pretty much made airtight.
And I have to tell you, because I know some of the writers and researchers, and I've been to a number of Jeopardy tapings, and Alex Trebek would have to go back and do 3 or 4 clues every round.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's about, I, that's kind of how I graded myself, because I'm pretty hard on myself. So it was like, you know, by the end, when we did 5 shows, obviously by the end, I got through enough to where it was like, okay, we're only picking up 3. And I was like, oh, that's a win. You know, the first show, the Monday show, I was picking up 8. And then by the time I got around to the end, after day 5, so to speak, was down to three or four. So I felt like I got better as the day went along.
Okay, so let me put you on the spot. What happens if they call and say, you're the guy, we want you?
I think that would be interesting. I don't know. Personally, and I've said this privately, and I'm happy to say it publicly, I think they go with a known quantity. I think they go with either Ken Jennings or Mike Richards himself, who's
did a good job.
He did a great job.
Yeah.
He's smart, good looking guy. He's hosted things before. He knows the game inside and out. He just basically did, if you think about it, he taught 15 people who come from all different, you know, whether it's Aaron Rodgers, a current NFL quarterback, or it's Katie Couric, or it's Savannah Guthrie. He taught 15 people like Jeopardy for Dummies, how to host Jeopardy for Dummies. And he basically wrote the handbook for it and made it really easy for everybody coming in. That's how well he knows it. So I would be stunned if that conversation happened. If it did, then I would have, I think, a lot to think about. And I'm not dismissing it because I do think it would be an interesting change of pace in my life. But I also know that they rightly want the person who hosts the show to have that be their thing. And I don't know, I would have to really think about it. I don't know if I'm willing to give up what I do currently to do that. Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't, but I felt like saying, you know, when people ask me when I got out of it, I don't think the answer's changed. Like I'll deal with that if and when that comes along, but I would be shocked if I have to deal with that.
Now you're also in sports, I understand.
Yes.
Yeah.
yes. I'm Jack Buck's son, and I grew up around sports and have been doing it for quite a while now.
You know, I loved your dad. Your dad was so nice to me when I was this young broadcaster for the San Diego Padres, and he's this Hall of Fame announcer for the Cardinals. He could not have been more gracious, more supportive. And, you know, like I said, I just love your dad. Really?
Well, I think he probably saw you coming in as somebody that was different in the best possible way. Considering your background, you know, you have an incredible sense of humor and a sharp wit, which I would say was the most underrated part of my dad. My dad was one of the quickest comics that I saw, and I would compare him to anybody. I saw him do speech after, you know, after dinner speech after after dinner speech, interact with people from presidents to, you know, a scout for the Seattle Mariners, and he had such a joy of the different people that he got to meet by through his job that he just became a real studier, if that's even a word, of the human condition. And so when he met you, like I did, I'm sure, I guarantee you, he was like, okay, this guy's smart, he's funny, and it's different than the typical conversation I'm having with somebody that's, you know, in this press box area. So he enjoyed everybody, and I'm glad to hear you. That's the best thing, Ken, about following my dad into this business is when people say, oh, you know, I worked with your dad at CBS back in the 80s, or, oh, you know, I did, I was with him back in Columbus, Ohio, back. I never have to worry about what the next part of the sentence is. Like, oh, that son of a bitch owed me $5,000 when he died, or, you know, what a prick, or whatever. You know, it's always, what a great guy that just loved being around people and was so nice to me. And so, of all the benefits I got of following him into this business, that part of it, kind of the human interaction of how he treated people, gave me a leg up with people that I then met in the network world. And I reaped those benefits as much as I did learning, you know, theoretically how to broadcast a baseball game.
You know, my daughter Annie is a TV writer, and she is now, along with her partner Jonathan, you know, taking meetings with network executives and people who I've worked with. And every so often I'll get a text from my daughter. It says, "Dad, thank you for not being an asshole."
Right. I'm telling you, it's a great gift. And you've done that for your daughter. And I'm telling you, of all the things I got from my dad, second to the inclusion that I had in his life and going with him, you know, my book is Lucky Bastard because I am exactly that. And I came along at a time where he, you know, had six kids and he'd been through this huge life change of divorce and everything else. And I think when I became the right age, which was really early, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, I would go with him on road trips and I was on the team bus and on the team charter and shagging balls in the outfield and playing catch in front of the dugout before games and being in that broadcast booth. And all of that inclusion I got from him was the number one gift he gave me. And the number two gift he gave me was just being a good guy that people liked and, you know, getting to follow him in that road was made a lot easier because of that.
Yeah, I know for my daughter, and of course people go, well, nepotism. But what I think, you know, since she grew up on sets her whole life,
yeah,
and she's part of a comedy family the way you're part of a broadcasting family, and I think the best thing that you get out of nepotism is that you are so well prepared when you get your opportunity.
I agree, and you know, I would be a hypocrite if I would not be truthful if I said that, you know, if my dad was not Jack Buck and I wasn't interested in this business, then I would not have been broadcasting in Louisville in 1989.
Which is where I met you.
Right, exactly. Yeah. When I was 19 or 20 years old. That's the part that's not going to happen if I'm not my dad's son. But then, you know, I did enough. I was doing all the Redbird games and I was setting up the equipment. I worked with a wonderful guy who could have been, he was everything I just said about my dad. He could have been, you know, his name's Jim Kelch. He's still a friend to this day. Got a text from him during the All-Star game. We're buddies. I owe him so much because when I came in, I was this 19-year-old kid. He had been working in AA Chattanooga and really worked his way up. And now here I am starting on third base, so to speak. And he couldn't have been nicer to me. But you're right in that when you grow up around it, yeah, doors are going to be open, but you're also, I was not intimidated to walk into a big league broadcast booth when I was doing the Cardinals at 21 years old, because I grew up in that booth and I knew what the mechanics were. And I wasn't in awe of the situation. I was still nervous and scared out of my mind, but being in the actual booth and being around the locker room, the clubhouse, and being on the field and talking to big league baseball players, that's what I'd done my whole life. And so I was getting a master's class every night of the summer and just kind of living my life. And then that all just seeped its way into my DNA. And then I was ready to kind of go do what I was doing at a very young age.
And speaking of being ready, you spent a number of years calling Cardinal games, calling a full season. And I contend you really need that experience behind you when you're doing big games on national television, because things are going to happen. And boy, I spent 3 years in the minors, and I am so glad I did, because I made a lot of mistakes on plays. And when I got to the majors and I saw those same plays, I instantly knew what to do and knew how to handle it. And I just think back to last year's World Series and Game 4 and that final play.
I was just going to bring that up, so go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, and you called that perfectly and confidently, where you got players, you know, diving back into third and the ball flying all over the field and runners going around, and you handled that just perfectly. You couldn't have done that when you were doing your third game with the Louisville Redbirds.
You're so right. And you know, add another layer to that. There we were at the you know, beginning of kind of the tail end. And I know this is probably not even right to say, but we had gone from not being in the actual stadium all year to finally at least being in the booth and being in the ballpark. And there were 11,000 fans in Arlington. And I laid awake that night after calling the end of that game where Will Smith's trying to make a swipe tag. A Rosarena had fallen on his face coming around third. Will Smith doesn't know that, so he misses the ball as he's hurrying. He could have just, you know, stopped, walked over and tagged him out, but he missed the ball trying to hurry. And I laid awake that night going, my God, if I was in a studio somewhere and just relying on what I saw on the monitor, I would have no idea what the hell happened, because I'm watching it happen and I can see out of the corner of my eye that Rosarena went face first into the grass. And then I can see on this side, you know, you needed that width of vision and that, you know, that scope to know all that was happening and then trying to put words to it. I'm glad it went well, but had I been doing that just in a studio off a TV screen, there's no way I would have been able to put the right words to that. And I would have had to clean it up after watching replays of it.
Yeah. Well, you just did the All-Star game, which I personally think an All-Star game would be very difficult to do because there's a million substitutions. The game doesn't really mean all that much. But you guys had fun being able to talk to players during the game and like talking to Freddie Freeman when he was actually at bat. That was pretty fun.
It is. I mean, not only is it taking viewers where they haven't been before, but it's taken me where I've never been before. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think I was one of the two people or three people walking the planet that liked the whole this time it counts stuff when after the tie in 2002 that they put a carrot at the end of the All-Star game because it made them actually consider some sort of strategy and not just have everybody come in and wave and then leave. So now we're not in that mode anymore and we're back to basically an exhibition. And so good for baseball and good for the Players Association. And you have to get yeses from both to be able to do that stuff, to talk to these guys while they're playing. It's the hardest game that I do all year because you could talk for two. I could have talked for four innings about Ohtani, but now you know there's three guys coming up in the first inning, and you want to tell their stories. You know, mm-hmm. here's Tatis Jr., and this guy's got a story a mile long already at 22, and here's Vlad Guerrero Jr., and you're just getting settled into the game, and you can't even talk about the brilliance of how great these guys are. And for every guy coming to the plate, there's a new shortstop, a new right fielder, a new center fielder. Add to that, they're wearing like these nondescript uniforms.
Awful.
I mean, unbelievable. So I'm watching from the best seat in the house, and I can't tell who's who. I mean, there's no distinct markings on any of these guys, except for, you know, whether it's if a guy's 6'10", or if he's, you know, got dreadlocks, or if he's, you know, whoever it is, you're looking for some characteristic to go, okay, that's who that is, because there's nine guys out there and they just, for whatever reason, I know they went to these new uniforms, but within those uniforms, the actual logo for the teams they represented were so small, I couldn't see them. So, you know, you're hoping that you're up to date with who just got into the game. And it just made the whole thing a lot more difficult.
If I can make a suggestion, never mic Liam Hendricks.
Oh, my God. So, Liam, for those who don't know, Liam Hendricks is from Perth and full of
the Tasmanian devil.
The Tasmanian devil and is cursing his ass off. And like I just did, and I'm looking at Smoltz when he's screaming at himself and Smoltz's face turns white. I'm like, and then our producer, I'm like, hey, this isn't going out over the air. Is it? He's like, well, no, we're on a 7-second delay, but I guess it did go out over the air.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. And so I'm like, how can that happen? If we're going to mic these guys, then you have to be really on the trigger to be able to tap out. And if the guy says something that shouldn't be on network TV, then you hit the button and people don't hear it. But I was stunned when nobody even really said anything to me. I just, somebody, my producer, the next day, I said, "Hey, I heard that the Liam Hendricks stuff got on the air." He's like, "I haven't heard that. Let me check into it." This is like 4 o'clock the next afternoon. And he's like, "Yeah, it did." And we were both stunned. So I, needless to say, A, you're right. He probably won't be mic'd again. And B, that will never get out again. God, I hope not.
Well, when it happened the first time, I just figured, all right, well, they're going to cut his mic. All right. And he kept it going.
Which I was saying to our audio guy, I'm like, just forget it. He can't hear me anyway. So just forget it. And, you know, a lot of these guys, they'll put the earpiece in, but there's a volume control on the earpiece, you know, the set that has the little pack that has the connection to the earpiece, as you know. And sometimes, you know, they, for good reason, you don't want somebody to put that in and the thing's on high and it blows their ear out. So they just put it way down. And it's loud out there, so he couldn't hear me. All right, so got it. He can't hear me. So let's forget it. And there have been times in the past where somebody has said something that I can hear in my headset, and I've apologized for it. And then I'm told, well, nobody heard that at home because we're on a delay. So having learned from those experiences, I didn't apologize for what he said, but it did get out. So I should have apologized for what he said, but I just assumed it was on delay.
Well, it was kind of a fun thing for those of us who stuck around to the end of the
right.
game.
Right. Just consider it our little gift to you to really hear what Liam Hendricks is saying to himself when he's not throwing strikes.
There you go. Part one of my two-part interview with Joe Buck. Next week, we talk a lot about football. Also, dealing with social media and what it is like that the minute you say something on the air, suddenly there are tweets and people are discussing it around the world. So that is next week. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. If you wish to get in touch with me, my email address is hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. That is hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. I am on Twitter, @KenLevine, if you wish to follow me. I'm also on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Come on back for part two next week with Joe Buck, right here on
Hollywood and Levine.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.